You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's weekly deep dive into the races, issues, and power struggles shaping America's democracy. As the 2026 midterm elections unfold, we go beyond campaign headlines to examine the policies, court battles, voting rights disputes, and grassroots movements driving the national conversation. Stay tuned for The Stakes.
The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
It's Thursday, June 4th, 2026. You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Scott Baba with Teresa Where's Bianska. The June primary results are in. Today on the show, we'll speak with Los Angeles Times columnist Gustavo Arellano on results from around the state, as well as Tim Redmond from 48 Hills about local results. All that and more coming up. You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Scott Baba with Teresa Where's Bianska. Millions of voters across six states headed to the polls Tuesday for primary elections ahead of key House, Senate, and gubernatorial races in November. In California, 61 candidates appeared on the ballot in the race to replace outgoing Governor Gavin Newsom. Under California's so-called jungle primary system, the top two vote-getters advanced to the general elections, regardless of party affiliation. MAGA-backed Republican Steve Hilton came in first place with 28% of the vote. Here is the former Fox News commentator speaking to his supporters Tuesday night.
I want to just say something from my heart to every single person who's voted for me. We're not there yet, but it's looking good. It looks very much as if Californians really will have the chance to vote for change in November and take our state in a new direction, a fresh start for our state.
Former California legislator, state attorney general, and secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Democratic candidate Javier Becerra came in second place with 25%. The two candidates will advance to the general election contest in November. Here's Becerra addressing his own crowd on Tuesday.
We stand here at the birthplace of El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora, La Reina de Los Ángeles del Río de Por Circunstabula. Better known as L.A. Like my family, L.A. is the starting line for millions of success stories across this state. And here in Hollywood's hometown, we love a good underdog story.
Democratic candidate Tom Steyer, the billionaire hedge fund manager turned environmentalist who supports a billionaire's tax and single-payer health care, did not make the runoff. Speaking to his supporters, Steyer warned California must do more to fight income inequality.
The gap between the rich and the poor grows wider by the minute. Prices are higher than ever. Faith in government's ability to do anything is lower than ever. Californians are being priced out of their homes every single day. While it happens, we see billionaires do whatever they have to get whatever they can out of the system, and then do everything they can to hoard their wealth and avoid paying taxes.
As people around California react to this week's primary election results, reporter Zofia Barr asked voters in Oakland about some of their reactions. She files this audio collage from Oakland.
Some thoughts about Tom Steyer.
Yeah.
I think Tom, with the way he tries to campaign against the smears that run against him, and I call them smears because you can't say that about somebody trying to point a true light on someone. if you want to point out the negative features, you have to point the light. You can't point a bad light at somebody and be like, let me catch you off guard, catch you at your worst moment. Tell the full story. Now, I won't call him billionaire Tom Sawyer, as people call him, but I will call him billionaire Tom Sawyer in the sense of how Trump then did it to make his money and learned how to hide the vote.
Well, the last time I looked, I voted for Becerra. And I'm horrified that Hilton is so strong because everybody's so upset about what Trump is doing. But it doesn't seem to be a push with the Republican Party. But anyway, the last I looked, Tom Sawyer was about 5 points behind. Have you had an update?
I think that Becerra is probably going to secure the nomination.
And he'll win. Because there's more Democrats in California than Republicans. So he'll be our next governor. And do you want to know why I didn't vote for Tom?
Of course.
I didn't vote for Tom for two reasons. A, this is his third time he's ran for an election, and he's trying to make something stick. Two, there was a lot of inconsistency. He said one thing, but really it was another thing. It was discovered, we don't know much about him. You know, I felt like it was a wolf in sheep clothing.
Yeah.
And he just spent so much money on commercials. It, you know, just really, it wasn't a positive experience for him.
So I'm pulling for Javier Becerra. I know I voted for Fiona Ma. I voted Democrat up and down the ticket. And so hopefully we have strong blue representation for California moving forward.
Cool. Thank you. Do you have any thoughts about who's running?
I feel very strongly that billionaires should not be in charge of any of us, but I still had to vote for Tom Steyer because he was a sponsored white member at McDonald's at Chevron.
How do you feel about Becerra taking the spot, probably?
I mean, I will vote for him. I've lived in California my entire life, and I've seen Arnold Schwarzenegger come through after a series of Democratic governors, and I don't think that people think that it's not going to change things the way that they think in a positive way.
Those were the voices of Bay Area voters reacting to this week's primary elections. They were gathered by reporter Zofia Barr. In Los Angeles, incumbent Mayor Karen Bass is advancing to a November runoff as she seeks a second four-year term. Reality show personality Spencer Pratt has come in second place with just over 30% of the vote. City Council member Nithya Raman is third with 21%. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass congratulated supporters Tuesday night in LA's Koreatown. Spencer Pratt hosted a private watch party and did not invite press to the event. In New Mexico, former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland won the Democratic nomination for governor. A member of the Laguna Pueblo, she could become New Mexico's first indigenous woman governor.
In Iowa, State Representative Josh Turek secured the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate, positioning himself to run for the seat being vacated by Republican Senator Joni Ernst. Turek, a former Paralympic gold medalist, was backed by Democratic Party leaders, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He defeated progressive challenger Zach Waltz in the primary. On the Republican side, Iowa voters chose farmer Zach Lane as their gubernatorial nominee. Lane narrowly edged out Congressman Randy Feenstra, the far-right candidate endorsed by President Donald Trump.
In Alameda County, early results show appointed District Attorney Ursula Jones-Dixon with more than 65% of the vote, putting her in a strong position to remain the county's top prosecutor. Former District Attorney Pamela Price, who was recalled by voters in 2024 after a turbulent reform-focused tenure, is trailing with about 23%. Price is urging supporters to remain patient, noting that thousands of ballots have yet to be counted and that late arriving votes could still reshape the race. Jones-Dixon, a former judge and longtime prosecutor, was appointed to lead the office after Price's recall and has rolled back many of Price's reforms. In New York, a closely watched Democratic primary is highlighting deep divisions over Israel. New York City Comptroller Brad Lander is challenging incumbent Congressman Dan Goldman, and during their first debate Monday, the two Jewish Democrats spent much of the evening clashing over Israel and Gaza. Lander has been an outspoken critic of Israeli government policies, while Goldman has positioned himself as a staunch supporter of Israel and has backing from AIPAC. Eileen Alfandari has more on this story.
The question of Israel dominated the beginning of the debate, so much so that New York Congressman Dan Goldman addressed this remark to debate moderator Errol Lewis of Spectrum News.
Israel, Errol, with all due respect, we're now 10 minutes into this and we've only spoken about Israel. Israel is not the most important issue in this district.
If not the most important, it is undeniably a very important issue. Jews make up an estimated 20% of the congressional district in Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn. The community was roiled by the October 7, 2023 Hamas massacre in southern Israel and is deeply divided over Israel's response, which human rights groups have labeled a genocide. That's a description challenger Brad Lander agrees with. He says the U.S. should stop sending weapons to Israel and that he would back legislation seeking to do just that.
We have some profound differences here. While Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, violating international law, violating Palestinian human rights, I believe we should not be sending additional U.S. military aid to Israel, and I won't be marching in the Israel Day parade alongside government ministers in Netanyahu's government, like Bezalel Smotrich, a war criminal who called it moral and just to starve Palestinians. Representative Goldman has voted for every standalone aid package to Israel.
Lander referred to the Israel Day march last Sunday, which he declined to attend. About 50,000 people marched, including a delegation of members of Israel's hardline government. Most controversial among them was extremist finance minister Bezalel Smotrich. Parade organizers said they didn't know he would show up. Goldman said he was also unaware that Smotrich would participate, but defended his own decision to march.
Well, I was proud to march in the Israel Day parade to celebrate the nation and state of Israel, a Jewish and democratic state that is distinct from its government. I strongly oppose this government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and apparently I was unaware that Bezalel Smotrich, one of the most radical extremists in that coalition government, also attended uninvited. I was unaware of that, and I am incredibly disappointed that that occurred because I have called for his removal. I have called for sanctions against him.
As of late April, a website that tracks political donations by the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, said Goldman had received more than $500,000 from the pro-Israel lobby. Goldman is an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune and is pouring $1 million of his own money into his reelection campaign. He has been endorsed by Governor Kathy Hochul and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, also of New York. The New York Times reported this week that a newly created super PAC founded to counter AIPAC would donate to Lander. The amount wasn't specified. Lander is endorsed by New York Mayor Soran Mamdani and Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. On other issues, both want to abolish Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Goldman, a former prosecutor who was lead counsel for President Donald Trump's first impeachment, has sued the Trump administration to open immigration detention centers to members of Congress. He has also used his congressional office to help immigrants connect to legal services. Lander has acted as a protester and court observer. He's been arrested twice, with the most recent case headed to a trial scheduled to take place just before the June 23rd primary. I'm Eileen Al.
On Tuesday, the Supreme Court ruled to allow Alabama to use a Republican-backed congressional map for this year's elections, despite lower court findings that the plan intentionally discriminated against black voters. In a 6-3 decision, the court granted Alabama's emergency request to reinstate a previously court-rejected map containing only one majority black district among the state's 7 congressional seats. A 3-judge federal panel had previously ruled the map intentionally and unlawfully diluted black voting strength and ordered the state to use a court-drawn map that created 2 districts where black voters formed a majority or a near-majority. The decision is the latest development in a broader redistricting battle that could affect Republicans' slim U.S. House majority. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey said the state will use the map in special congressional primaries August 11th. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by the court's other liberals, dissented, saying the ruling permits the use of a map previously found to intentionally discriminate against black Alabamians and could create election chaos. In her dissent, she wrote, quote, "In addition to being wrong on the merits, the court's decision inflicts 2 grave harms on the public. It debases the democratic process by upending Alabama's entire election in the name of permitting Alabama to discriminate against black Alabamians. It also corrodes the rule of law by rewarding Alabama's gamesmanship and outright defiance of court orders."
In the San Joaquin Valley, one primary election for Congress was in the national spotlight, featuring a contest between dueling Democrats trying to turn a district long held by a Republican blue. Vic Bedoyan reports from Fresno.
California's 22nd congressional district has been an enigma for Democrats. Now they're hoping that the Proposition 50 redrawing of the lines will favor them even more than in the past. It has long had a distinct Democratic majority in registration and a majority Latino population. But Republican David Valadao, who came from a local farming family, has regularly beaten seemingly viable Democratic candidates. Progressives got behind Randy Villegas early in the campaign season. He's a College of Sequoias professor and former community organizer with expertise in voting rights. Then, as they have in the past, the National Democratic Party stepped in to back a candidate they figured would more likely defeat Valadao. That was Dr. Jasmeet Baines. She is a family physician that represents the 35th Assembly District in the South Valley. She's the daughter of Sikh immigrants and the first South Asian woman to serve in the state assembly. She's considered a moderate. That spawned a furor among local Democrats. Local party leader Kathy Jorgensen told The Guardian, "These are some out-of-touch people, and they are reading things wrong." She said the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, in wanting to be safe, are hurting the party instead. After that, Villegas received endorsements from Bernie Sanders, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and United Farm Workers founder Dolores Huerta. Many votes are yet to be counted, so it's unclear who Valadao will face in the general election. In other Valley congressional races, incumbents all survived to contest the general election. Longtime Democrat Congressman Jim Costa will face Republican Kyle Kirtland for the 21st District in November. Kern County's Republican Vince Fong got 70% of the vote and is expected to win a GOP-favorable district. In the North Valley, Democrat incumbent Adam Gray might have a close contest to keep the 13th District. And incumbent Democrat Josh Harder in the 9th District has nearly 58% of the vote so far and will contest the GOP's John McBride in the general. Looking at the Valley's election results for governor, Republican Steve Hilton won Fresno County handily with 38% of the vote. That compares with Javier Becerra at 19.6% and Tom Steyer with 16.4%. There were similar results in other Valley counties. That's an indication that Republican voting was just as enthusiastic as Democrats this time, if not more. Vic Bedoyan reporting for Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba.
Joining us now to break down what happened in the California primary this week is Los Angeles Times political columnist Gustavo Arellano. Thanks for joining the show, Gustavo.
Gracias for having me.
Let's start with the governor's race. Republican and former Fox News host Steve Hilton took the lead with around 28% right now to Democrat Javier Becerra's 25%. leaving Democrat Tom Steyer out of the runoff. What does his performance tell us about the mood of California voters right now?
Californians do not like billionaires trying to buy, or super rich people, let's put it that way, to buy their way into elections. I mean, this has been a hallmark of my political life. I'm 47 years old. I remember Michael Huffington running against, who was it, Barbara Boxer, spending millions of dollars, and everyone saying, oh, it's unprecedented spending. Then you get Meg Whitman. Then you get Al Cechi. Well, Al Cechi before Meg Whitman. Then 2 years ago, no, 4 years ago, you had Rick Caruso, the billionaire developer down here in LA, trying to buy his way into the mayoral seat. And again, you had Tom Steyer. And look, Tom Steyer was saying the right progressive things, had given the right progressive money. All my progressive friends were cheering him on. And it looks like right now he's not even going to make it into the general election. So that's the first one. And then second one, I mean, this is still a blue state. So, okay, Steve Hilton has 28% of the lead right now, you said, at least the most recent numbers. His main rival, Chad Bianco, had like 12%. Ooh, so now you have 30% of the electorate. All those other Democrats, they're not going to go for Hilton, especially the more he spews his MAGA light rhetoric.
Republicans, though, are having a field day with this.
Yeah.
They're pointing. I want to talk about your home county of Orange County.
Yeah.
Went to Hilton. Republicans are saying it's turning back red. What do you say about that?
Absolutely not. Look, they topped out at 30% of the total vote. And Hilton, honestly, Hilton's biggest advantage is that he has a British accent. Americans are always enamored of that British accent. But once he starts spouting off crap like, oh, I am the candidate of legal immigrants, well, you're going to annoy a lot of Mexican-Americans like myself who are not as progressive as one may make them out to be, but their parents were undocumented or they themselves were undocumented. When you hear stuff like that, they're going to say, absolutely not. And not only that, like any independents who are on the line, you know, like just towing the line between Democrats or Republicans, they're going to see someone like Javier Becerra. And the big knock against him is that he's boring and that he represents the status quo. But look, you have now the first, it seems like the first ever Latino to make it into the general election with the big hope that you're going to have California's first ever Latino elected governor. He's going to bring out a lot of people to the polls. The Republicans, and I know in other races they're leading. Lieutenant Governor Gloria Romero has a narrow lead. Sonia Shaw for Secretary of Education. These are all fire-breathing Republicans, but they're nowhere near a majority. And the reality is California is a deep blue state, as unpopular as the Democratic establishment may be. Who's even less popular? Anyone aligned with MAGA, period.
Yeah, like, so what kind of campaigns do you see happening then between Hilton and Becerra?
Hilton, to me, is the more fascinating character. Because Becerra, God bless him, he's going to be boring establishment Dem, sprinkled in with Spanish and a great story. His family, his parents were working class Mexican immigrants. He was a first in his college. Like his story is inspiring. Absolutely. His achievements, you could disagree with most of his policies, but you can't deny the fact that he has done something and for the most part, good of the people that he serves. So he's going to be boring. The person who's going to be interesting is Steve Hilton, and he's already established some of that. I mean, he really is banking on class warfare, saying California has become way too expensive for everyone. He coined, like the Brits do, he coined a very, what would you call it, a twee term, Californability. This idea that it's just not affordable. And he has been going around the working class areas of the state, which happen to be in this day and age mostly Latino. So the Central Valley, we're talking about El Monte, we're talking about Barstow. He knows, because I have had personal conversations with him before he ran for governor, but I knew he was going for higher office. He was just saying, like, what can we do to make California a better state for Latinos? His campaign will live or die on Latinos, but now he has to deal with the inconvenient or inconvenient reality that he's going to be running against a Latino. So it's going to be funny to try to see him out Latino, the actual Latino. But that's the only chance Steve has.
That would be interesting to see. I want to move now to the LA mayor's race, where incumbent mayor Karen Bass took a victory with 36% of the vote, but then reality star Spencer Pratt is also advancing to the runoff. And you wrote that many people have underestimated him by just dismissing him as a celebrity. What is the appeal? What's going on in your perspective?
Again, it's Trumpian. The problem with the left, and let's really blame liberals, right? Not progressives, liberals. The problem with liberals is that they continue to underestimate populism. They think that rationality will trump, pardon the horrible pun, any sort of anger, any sort of just plain spoken babble mouths. These are the same people who thought Adlai Stevenson would be Dwight David Eisenhower. That's for the more August members of August listeners out there. They thought Trump stood no chance. So same thing with Spencer Pratt. Like, he was dismissed as a joke early on, though. I knew, like, he had the compelling story that he lost everything in the Palisades fire, which everyone now acknowledges was a gross exercise in gross incompetency by all levels of LA government. Although I personally think it's been too much put on the mayor, Karen Bass. And so you add to that just this, anti-establishment sentiment, which I'm writing about in my LA Times column. And also the fact that Spencer knows how to perform in front of the cameras. And yeah, I'm not surprised he finished in second place. And then on top of that, the fact that the third place, at least who's in standing in third place, Councilmember Nithya Raman, who were her supporters? Because it certainly wasn't DSA members who felt betrayed by her running at the last moment and thereby basically asking them to redirect resources toward her campaign. They declined to endorse her, although they recommended people vote for her. All her fellow three DSA city council members in LA, they all endorsed Karen Bass. And also, she ran as a wonk. And voters right now do not want wonks. They want people who are angry. They want people who are motivated. And that's why Nithya seems to be on the outside looking in. And Spencer is going to be, at the very least, giving us a very entertainingly apocalyptic 5 months.
Given that analysis of Raman's voters, do you think they'll break towards Bass in the general?
They have to, because I was at Raman's election night party, and she inveighed, rightfully so, against MAGA coming in to Los Angeles and trying to dictate what's what. It's going to be interesting to see whether Raman tries to make amends with Mayor Bass if Raman doesn't go into the general election. But there's no way on earth, there's no way on earth Raman's going to break with Pratt. But one never knows in politics, especially with populist politics. But by the way, this is what a lot of people were saying Bass wanted, that she wanted a matchup with Spencer because of the scenario that I laid out in California politics overall, that this is a super blue state. But here's the problem with that, is that once you, and again, this is what liberals do not learn, once you uncork populism, it is really hard to try to stop it. Like, if it starts rolling, and Spencer has just been on a J-curve upswing, it is his campaign to mess up. I'm not saying he's going to win. He still has a lot of work to do, but it is his campaign to mess up, and there's nothing that can be thrown at him that hasn't been thrown at him already that could derail him. So he is going to be the one who's going to ruin his chances.
And I think a lot of it comes down to the homeless issue. Nithya Raman has faced a lot of criticism from some people in LA that she's, like, famously, I guess, lenient. What do you know about what Spencer Pratt is trying to promise in terms of, like, cleaning up encampments? I think some people are feeling kind of nervous about what that means for homeless communities.
Whole-scale eradication. He has promised it. He has said he's going to get rid of all unhoused people from the streets, move them onto federal property. These are his words, not mine. I'm not paraphrasing. And those who do not choose to leave, they'll just pack them up and put them on a bus to Seattle, where the mayor will supposedly house them or at least take them in. And that has been my biggest concern with Pratt's campaign. Look, I could allow, I totally understand his righteous fury, at especially what happened with the Palisades fire because he lost his house there. He has every right to run, but his dehumanizing language against the unhoused people, I mean, it's straight out of the anti-immigrant rhetoric that LA was seeing 30 years ago. And I think that's going, if he does not change his tune, that's going to give a lot of voters pause. Do you really want a demagogue? And that's the other thing, though. Because the unhoused crisis has, I'm not going to say transform liberals into people who want to vote for demagogues like Pratt. I think it's just exposing so-called liberals for the unkind people that they, unkind, intolerant people that they actually are. These are the people who still think Los Angeles is stuck in the San Fernando Valley in the 1970s, this beautiful, like a wonderland out of a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and have never been comfortable with LA's new multicultural progressive reality. But again, it's going to be interesting.
Turning back to Pratt's populism, you wrote that Pratt feels the pulse of LA's civic malaise. What specific concerns are voters expressing that he's been most effective at tapping into?
I really think it has been both the Palisades fire, the response or lack of response to the Palisades fire, and the homelessness crisis. He knows how to insult. And look, by calling the mayor Karen Basura, which in Spanish, basura means trash, that sticks in people's minds. And that, you know, it's a toxicity in politics. And I am not agreeing with any of that. But I do think that he has done, that a strategy has taken him this far. And here's the other important thing. His supporters are very, very enthusiastic, and that's putting it as nicely as I possibly can. Bass's supporters, not as much, but so what you're going to see and what she needs to do, she needs to activate people who are afraid of Pratt's followers. I'm afraid of Pratt's followers more than I am afraid of Pratt himself. And so he's going to have to activate those fearful of that scenario of Pratt at City Hall and bring them out into the office. I mean, we already have a midterm where you're going to have motivated anti-Trumpers coming out to vote in congressional races and, you know, statewide races and all that. She just needs to now convince people that she should have another chance despite everything. You know, we mentioned, or you folks mentioned, that she was leading as of election night with 36% of the vote. That means, though, that two-thirds of Angelenos did not want her as mayor. That is, that's not a fatal card dealt to her, but her campaign better be waving warning flags and saying, we need to do a far better job than what we have done so far to get those voters and ensure a second term.
Certainly this mayor's race in Los Angeles has captured the imagination and attention of the entire country. But what other races besides governor and LA mayor have you been watching and feel like has special significance right now?
We'll still stick to LA's, and that's the subject actually of my columna, my most recent one. Whereas all the national attention is being put to Pratt and the LA mayor's race, quietly, the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America got five of their six endorsed candidates to move on into the general election or essentially have such a commanding lead that they're almost guaranteed to win outright. And that is huge news. Again, the national media, they like to do the simple story. So they were trying to make out Rahman to be a new Mamdani. No, it was not going to happen, even though DSA endorsed her in her first term in 2020, which set off the entire progressive move. But just to show you how much voters in Los Angeles have swung populist. I'm not going to say left or right, but populist. So you on one spectrum, on one end of the spectrum, you have Pratt, but his mirror opposite is going to be the left. And so again, from in six years ago on primary night, DSA in LA was just seen as upstarts that were not going to do anything. 4 years later, you have four DSA council members. Two of them ran for re-election, are most likely going to win.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can actually speak to this, but if you've been following state races at all, do you see the districts that were rearranged by Prop 50 going the way that mapmakers thought they would go, or are Republicans still getting in places that they weren't expected to?
I mean, the interesting race, and the interesting race for me out of the congressional races was down here in Orange County, actually, Congressional District 40, which was starting to lean Democrat. It had been held by Young Kim, a Korean American Congress member, and it was a purple district. And so that was actually a winnable district. A lot of people felt for the Democrats, but you have this congressional gerrymandering, and all of a sudden, what could have been a swing district became solidly Republican. So I think and then of course you have another race going down. I know in San Diego County, Darrell Issa's old seat, the longtime Republican Congress member who saw the new map and decided they weren't going to run. But now you have a Republican, I believe it's a Republican supervisor and a Democratic council member. So San Diego council member, San Diego County supervisor going on into the general election. Democrats made that into a more playable seat. I still think it's going to be Republican, but I think at the end of everything, California will get five more congressional Democrats, having effectively erased the other Republicans. But then at the same time, you had gerrymandering in Virginia. Well, the Virginia is supposed to go for, of course, Democrats, but gerrymandering for Republicans in Texas, in Indiana, and all that. People hate Trump. People absolutely loathe Trump right now. If we stay at this current condition with the economy and Iran and all that, I don't see the Republicans winning outside of more machinations. But hey, that's 5 months away. Maybe the election booms like crazy. Who knows? Who absolutely knows? But in California, yep, the resistance, the blue resistance is still strong, and it's interesting to see how it's going to play out for the future.
It is interesting to see, and we're going to be watching closely as you are, I'm sure. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gustavo.
Gracias for having me.
And we've been speaking with Gustavo Arellano, political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. One of the most closely watched races in California is unfolding in San Francisco, where longtime Congress member Nancy Pelosi is retiring after nearly 4 decades in office. With thousands of ballots still left to be counted, the race to succeed her appears headed for a November runoff between State Senator Scott Wiener and San Francisco Supervisor Connie Chan. Wiener currently holds a lead with over 41% of the vote, while Chan is running second at just under 29%. Chan picked up Pelosi's endorsement late in the campaign. To help us break this down, Tim Redmond from 48 Hills spoke with Upfront's Brian Edwards Tekert.
First of all, why don't you tell us about Connie Chan, now that it looks like she's secured herself a spot in the runoff, who is she politically? Who's her coalition?
Yeah, Connie has been part of the progressive movement in San Francisco for many years. She has the support of the vast majority of the labor unions in the city. She has strong labor support and has always been one of labor's favorites at City Hall. She has several times run the Budget and Finance Committee and attempted to prevent layoffs and cuts from unionized jobs. She also, if you look at, and I'm just looking at preliminary results because there's a lot of ballots still to be counted, she did very, very well on the west side of town. And while turnout was low, turnout among people who requested a Chinese language ballot was actually higher than turnout, percentage-wise, I'm saying. Was actually higher than overall city turnout. And I think Connie Chan benefited immensely from that. She basically won. It looks like she won most of the Sunset and the Richmond, which is interesting because those West Side precincts are not always progressive. In fact, the mayor's candidate, Alan Wong, beat a progressive candidate for supervisor pretty handily in District 4. But a lot of those same votes went to Connie Chan. So she Now, the thing to remember is, as you mentioned earlier, Scott Wiener is right now around 41% of the vote. It's going to change a little bit up and down a little bit as the remaining ballots are counted. But it's going to be the two of them running off. And as you mentioned, more than half of the people who voted in the race voted for someone other than Scott Wiener. So, in fact, 59% of the people who voted in the race voted for someone who wasn't Scott Wiener. That's why he got 41%. So the question is, number one, will Shroikot Chakrabarty's voters get behind Connie Chan now? Now, Shroikot Chakrabarty told me 2 days ago that if Connie Chan came in second ahead of him, he would endorse her and he would tell his supporters to back her. There's been a little bit of bad blood between them of late, because not Shroikot himself as much as some of his allies have put out an extremely misleading series of ads saying that Connie Chan is supported by AIPAC. Connie Chan is not supported by AIPAC. If AIPAC has a candidate in this race, it's Scott Wiener. It is absolutely not Connie Chan. But they put out this misleading stuff, and that angered a lot of Chan supporters. But, you know, the question is, will Chakrabarty's voters now turn around and say, well, we went for the guy who really wanted to shake up the system, but the most establishment Democrat in the race, the corporate Democrat in the race, is Scott Wiener. At the same time, the most establishment Democrat perhaps in the country is Nancy Pelosi, who has endorsed Connie Chan. So, but late in the race. So now Pelosi's support will unlock, I think, a lot of money for Connie Chan. She was badly outspent by both Wiener and Chakrabarty. But yet, being outspent, Chakrabarty spent $8 million and has, at this point, 16,000 votes to show for it. Connie Chan raised, I think, about 470,000, less than 500,000. She had a labor independent expenditure committee that also was putting up money for her. But if she can stay competitive with Scott Wiener in the fundraising battle, it's going to be a really interesting race in the fall. Now, I'm just going to say, I am a journalist, Brian, and I have to say every time I talk about this that my daughter, who is an adult, independent, does not live with me, is working for Connie Chan for Congress. So I disclose that all the time. Some of Shroikot's people have said, oh, you must be biased, and I say I've been biased for 45 years, and my biases have been clear for a long, long time, and have nothing to do with what particular campaigns my kids, both of whom work on campaigns, are working on. At any rate, set that aside. It's going to be interesting. Scott, of course, Wiener is in the lead by, at this point, like 10 points. He has already twice won citywide elections for state Senate. And, you know, he will have pretty much unlimited money from big tech and real estate. He is the tech and real estate candidate. Connie will be the labor candidate and possibly get national labor money because having someone who has worked so closely with labor in Congress would be a big benefit. Also, Connie Chan would be the first generation immigrant from San Francisco to represent the city in Congress. She moved here from Hong Kong when she was 13 years old, speaking no English, and has gone on to serve in numerous positions in the city and is in her second term as the supervisor from District 1. So it's going to be a fascinating race.
That was the voice of editor of 48 Hills, Tim Redmond, speaking with KPFA's Brian Edwards-Tiekert on Upfront. Coming up next, we turn to our regular media literacy segment from Project Censored, the longtime media watchdog group focused on underreported stories, corporate media influence, and critical news analysis. Here are Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored.
Hello, I'm Mickey Huff from the Project Censored Show with Eleanor Goldfield, my co-host, and we are doing a segment where we look at the headlines and we look at current events through the lens of critical media literacy as applied to the coming midterm elections. And today we're going to apply critical media literacy lens and look at the concept of framing, language choice, and so forth in the way that the corporate news media in the U.S. has been covering the ongoing attacks in Gaza by the Israeli government. There's a new book out from Adam Johnson coming out. It is coming out. And in it, he analyzes thousands of news articles, proving there is a pro-Israeli bias in the corporate media in the West. He recently published a piece for The Intercept, and in it, he shared some of the key findings. So, Eleanor, let's just start this out. The book is titled How to Sell a Genocide, The Media's Complicity in the Destruction of Gaza, looking at media framing and propaganda. And Eleanor, you know, of course, we've talked about framing in the past. Framing is sort of the Overton window that's shrunken by corporate media, where they cover what's supposed to matter to the public. But what falls outside of that window is often very important, and it can be obviously very factual and significant. So in this case, what Johnson's study is doing is he looked at 12,000 articles from the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Politico, Axios, USA Today, and the Associated Press, along with 5,000 TV segments that aired on CNN and MSNBC. And to quote him from his article on The Intercept, said, "The focus is on center-left media outlets influential with the Biden administration during the first year of the conflict, with an emphasis on the first few months when Israel firmly established its narrative justifying the genocide, rendering mass death inevitable." And then he presents statistical findings, matter of fact, that prove the U.S. media's bias against Palestinians. And Eleanor, why would this be so significant of an issue as we're in a midterm election year?
To quote Robin D.G. Kelly, who wrote, "If you were able to overlook a genocide and cast a vote for Harris, you already know how a conservative was able to overlook Trump's extremism and vote for him." And this is not about throwing stones. This is just about the way that our public officials are framed by the media is not honest. It's not transparent. The media never tells you that they're on this or that side. And as we've covered before, Mickey, there is no such thing as objective journalism. It's all subjective. Depending on how you're framing it, depending on who's paying you to frame it a certain way. And of course, with regards to the corporate media that Adam Johnson has discussed here, they are all on the side of Zionism. That is the perpetuation of Israel as an ethno-state, a genocidal ethno-state, an apartheid genocidal ethno-state. And so how does that then relate to these public officials that pretty much, for the most part, all seem to be Zionist? How are they talking about the money flowing, for instance, from AIPAC? How are these things being reported if they're being reported? You know, Adam points out, for instance, the right to defend itself. That right is always given to Israel. It's never given to Palestine, right? Is that right given to Iran, given to Lebanon? Was that right given to Iraq, Afghanistan? I mean, we can go back to Vietnam and even before, right? Who has the right to defend themselves against U.S. empire and our allies, such as Israel? But I think it's important to note that critical media literacy is important for being an informed citizen, and it means that you recognize how you're being lied to, not just by the media outlets, but by the politicians themselves, so that we can all do better and that we can all get better when it comes to public servants.
Right. And Eleanor, this article continues to go on about the language about human shields and who that language is applied to. Again, the news outlets disproportionately refer to civilians near Palestinian militants as human shields. It's a very selective application. Johnson goes on to talk about emotive words about killing civilians, and he analyzes it both in print and on cable news. So there's a lot of material to go down. You know, you could really go down the rabbit hole with looking at the way in which that the conflict is being framed in an incredibly pro-Israeli way. And so, again, the critical media lens it's not just hitched to something that criticizes Israel. It criticizes all media and the way in which that those outlets choose to frame and cover subjects. It just so happens, Eleanor, that the corporate media coverage of what's been happening in Israel-Palestine has been so extraordinarily skewed and one-sided that there are now several academic books coming out showing the proof is literally in the numbers and the examples. And that's what we want to focus on, is the matter-of-fact reporting and analysis. And that's what critical literacy is for. It says, who wants me to know this, analyzes why, who's being paid, who benefits from what the messages are and what the messages are not being told, who's a worthy victim, who's not worthy. And that all comes out in the wash when we see how the corporate media tend to frame what's going on in the Middle East. And I know that there's a lot we could unpack here, but this is just one topic. And again, we're going to be coming back to this segment in The Stakes to look at critical media literacy and how we can use it to understand what's happening around elections. And quite clearly, Eleanor, to connect it to what's coming up here in the fall, garbage in, garbage out. If people have a steady flow of one-sided propaganda, they're not going to have a clear understanding of major issues. And we saw that in the poor autopsy that the Democrats did of their own failed election. We saw, of course, an actual analysis of that by other independent groups that showed the bitter failure of Democrats to even acknowledge Gaza or Palestine once in their self-examination of how they lost the presidential election, even though there have been numerous reports that show that in swing states in particular, the issue of Gaza probably gave the election to Trump. Anyway, I think we're probably out of time for this segment. There's a lot more to look into. You can check out Adam Johnson's article over at The Intercept from May 12. We analyzed thousands of news articles. Here's the proof of pro-Israeli bias in corporate media. And of course, you can check out his book, How to Sell a Genocide, Eleanor. As usual, it's fine to cut up the news and look through a critical media lens. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in to The Stakes.
Those were the voices of Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored. That's it for the show. The Stakes airs Thursdays at 10 a.m. Check for information about topics and guests online at kpfa.org. For comments and ideas, connect with us at news@kpfa.org. A big thanks to the team, Lauren Schmidt, Jose Gonzalez, our engineers, Kirsten Thomas. I'm your host, Teresa Wierzbianska, with Scott Baba. See you next week on The Stakes.